Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Marley was dead, to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it, and Scrooge's name was good upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail.
Mind, I don't mean to say that I know of my own knowledge what there is particularly dead about a doornail. I might have been inclined myself to regard a coffin nail as the deadest piece of ironmongery in the trade, but the wisdom of our ancestors is in the simile, and my unhallowed hands shall not disturb it, or the country's done for. You will therefore permit me to repeat emphatically that Marley was as dead as a doornail.
Poor, poor Marley. I love it. Oh, that's good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a book that is going to be famous one day. It's going to be big.
Well, now that you've plucked it out of obscurity.
Fantastic. I love this book. A Christmas Carol, of course, by Charles Dickens.
Yes.
Our second Dickens, right?
Yeah, it is.
And our third one hopefully is coming.
Yes. But Bleak House is so long.
Oh, yes, it sure
and
is.
Complex. And this one is so compact. It's really a novella, if that. And yet it embodies all the things about Dickens that make him so wonderful in his other books. And so really, you know, people have often said, what's your favorite Dickens? And that's hard to say, but this might be the perfect introduction, if nothing else.
Oh, yeah. Well, it is the only one I had read before Bleak House.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, yeah.
Bleak House must have been a huge surprise.
So much to learn. I'm curious about where in his career did this fall?
Right after Martin Chuzzlewit. So now you really know something, right?
Yep.
I was reading up on it, and I can't remember what was next. I thought maybe David Copperfield was after that, but you'd have to look. But Martin Chuzzlewit was not making the money he hoped it would make.
Hmm.
And he kind of dashed this off while he was thinking about whatever the next book was. And I say dashed it off, meaning it was, you know, so short for him. But he then printed it in a really wonderful edition. And the publisher had offered him a flat rate. And he said, no, I'll take a percentage. But because it was such a nice, expensive edition, and they could only charge so much, he didn't make very much money. And then they had trouble with copyright laws so that anybody could copyright it. Or not copyrighted. Anybody could kind of take it and pirate it, like, say, in America, and he couldn't get the money for it.
Wow.
So the poor guy. I mean, and then one company he did actually sue, who was in Britain, Great Britain, for it. And they were like, fine, but we're bankrupt now.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it was hugely popular.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. That was my next question. Did people at the time love it?
Oh, my gosh. I think he sold 7,000 copies.
Wow. 1843.
Yep. Yeah, within a very short time.
How about that? So he started writing in 1836, and Great Expectations was in 1860. Yeah. So he's kind of in the middle of his career.
What was the one right after this one, though?
After Christmas Carol was Chuzzlewit.
Oh, and I thought it was right before. Okay.
Yeah, I'm showing that. And then it says Dombey and Son. Was serialized from 1846 to 1848.
Yeah.
Gosh, he wrote so many things in serial.
Everything, really, I think.
Mm. Yeah, except for this one because it was short.
Right.
Wow. So we probably need to avoid spoilers. You know, this is one of those books, again, I think the last time we talked about kind of a cultural thing was Frankenstein, and how Frankenstein is really part of the culture, even though it may not be the book Frankenstein, because people, you know, whenever they read Frankenstein, they're surprised when they read it for the first time. But this book is definitely part of the fabric of certainly my life, you know, and I, it seems like everybody knows this story.
Yeah, because even if you don't have all the details of this book, the essentials of the story are carried on even when you're watching, you know, what is it, Scrooge McDuck?
Yeah.
You know?
Yep, and, Scrooge McDuck. And then there's so many variations of this story and films and stories. And yeah, the visiting of ghosts, you know, ghost present, ghost past, ghost future, Christmas to be, right? And then seeing your life, you know, is another. It's really right. Science fiction in a way. You know, you're seeing a timeline of your life if you things keep going as they are. And
well, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, and with an opportunity to change it.
Oh, yeah. And I recently was talking about a movie which was really terrible. So I won't mention the name, but it was about time travel. And I was thinking about other stories about time travel. And I was like, well, this is actually a time travel story, really. Yeah, it's a ghost story, but also time travel at the same time.
Yeah.
In a sense. And speaking of cultural traditions, I just wanted to mention that this book is kind of at the heart of two different things. One is there's a British tradition of ghost stories at Christmas time. And I guess you know about that, right?
Well, no, I didn't.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. I knew about it because I'm a great lover of M.R. James's ghost stories. And
yeah.
He was, his first collection of ghost stories came out in 1904. So he'd have been writing after Dickens. But he was an Oxford don who wrote ghost stories or a ghost story each Christmas. And he would tell it to the students who were there at the school. And it goes back very far back as a British tradition. And they think maybe it came from Celtic times. But in fact, Shakespeare in A Winter's Tale in, from 1623 says, "A sad tale's best for winter. I have one of sprites and goblins." So that's kind of how they can track back. It goes really far back. And it was kind of starting to fade out a little. And then the Victorians got a hold of it and just loved it. So families would stay home or big groups of people and they would tell ghost stories. And it goes on through it through time after this because he kind of helped popularize it again at the same time as it was experiencing resurgence. So that's what he's building on. But when you think about The Turn of the Screw, which was from 1898, that's set as a Yuletide tale.
No kidding.
It says it was a Christmas Eve, you know, the frame story, which is very brief.
Right.
And we were telling stories. And then, you know, this story, The Turn of the Screw, gets told. So there's that cultural thing. And then the other cultural part is that.
So before you move on, so was that cultural thing, did this spawn that or was it existing and he wrote this?
No, it existed. I mean, because like I say,
okay, because you said it was pretty old because you Winter's Tale. Yeah.
They think maybe it goes back to Celtic times, but it's always been one of their traditions.
How interesting. I like it. Cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, so the other cultural thing is, and I read a book about this, which of course I can't remember the name, but I think it's called How Dickens Saved Christmas or Defined Christmas or something like that. I'll find it and we can put it in the show notes. But basically, he defined what the modern Christmas is. Everybody had goose before. After this book, everybody wanted turkey. And a lot of the old customs had died out. And people weren't making such a big deal out of Christmas. And so by telling this story and showing all the trimmings and the, you know, Fezziwig's dance and the games that the nephew's playing and all that kind of thing, everybody glommed onto that and went, I want that kind of Christmas. And so that set up what we now experience, essentially fed into everything that is culturally ours in America, too. And it's really kind of an interesting phenomenon of the popularity of the book on a lot more levels than we think about.
Wow, that's cool. I like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of the stuff has gone off the rails, of course, culturally.
Right.
But yeah, that's neat. I do have such fond memories of Christmas growing up. And this book has always been part of it. I couldn't tell you when the first time I read it was.
No,
but I've read
either.
It a few times.
Well, I had a kid's version, which I still have. It's a great big one. It's fairly complete, but, you know, big type and big pictures and all that kind of stuff. And And then, you know, what happens is you get to watching the movies or hearing people tell variations of the story, and you forget to go back and read the original.
Right, right. Yeah, back in the theater group I was in a town I previously lived in, one time we were trying to find a non-musical version of this, and it was difficult, which surprised me.
Yeah.
But we did end up finding one, but that like I said, that surprised me. I'm not sure why that is.
I know.
Yeah. And it's public domain. We should be able to write our own, but still.
Yeah. That's a lot of work.
When I think about movie versions of this, all I can think of are variations. Like, the main one that pops in my head is Scrooged. Bill Murray, and that's one that's really interesting and funny.
Interesting, but I've only seen it once because I was like, okay.
Yeah.
But you know, it's funny because when you say that, the first thing I thought of, which is not a favorite of mine, but is a favorite in the household, is The Muppets Christmas Carol.
Ah.
Which is relatively faithful. I mean, they're all relatively faithful.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But you know, my favorite is the Alastair Sim one, which I think is from 1957, maybe?
I'm not sure that I've seen it.
Black and white. Mm-hmm. You'll see a lot of people mention him. They either say it's the greatest, or I know people like this one, but I like this other one better.
Huh.
It's definitive in a lot of ways, and he is just wonderful. I mean, you've never seen a better Scrooge. I've seen George C. Scott, and that's fine, and I listened to the Patrick Stewart abbreviated one, and that's fine, but nobody did a better pinched up old guy than Alastair Sim.
I need to watch that one. I haven't seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was going to mention the Patrick Stewart version because I really like that. No, don't be sorry. It's about 2 hours long, hour 45 minutes, and an unabridged audio version is 3 hours. So it is. I actually read this time through. I turned it on and I was reading with it a little bit to see what was missing. And it's not, it's just various things. He all the attributives are gone. So like, you know, he said, she said, he does all that with voice. And then, which is something that I think they ought to do in audiobooks more often.
Mm-hmm.
And then, he just skips some paragraphs. It's like somebody went through and said, well, I think we can do without that. We can do without that. And the story still works. And, so it was interesting to see how it was abridged.
Yeah.
But well, still very, very good. Yeah.
Yeah, and I listened to it, and the only thing I really objected to in it, because it was a good reading or narration of it, but was that most of the nephew's party was gone.
Ah, yeah.
And I liked a lot of that, you know.
Sure.
Because it showed Scrooge getting really engaged with the people.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like wanting to play and that kind of thing. And
unabridged is always better. Can't deny it.
Well, yeah. And my favorite reading of it, which I went back to after that, was Tim Curry's reading.
Oh, yes.
Which is, I think Audible had him do it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that is on Audible. They were doing some signature readings, and he was one of them. Yeah, one of the early ones.
You know, not as good as you starting us off.
Yeah.
Let's not be,
I can hardly say it without trying to do Patrick Stewart. Molly was dead to begin with.
Yeah, and it's funny, after listening to Tim Curry, who seems much more subdued, but what happens is he saves the emphasis for the voices or other things.
Yeah.
And Patrick Stewart, after a while, he was just always over the top, it seemed like to me. And I know it's because he's done a one-man show of it.
Right.
And you have to, because you're the only one they're looking at and listening to. But it's funny, I love his voice and how he reads and everything, but it just was a little less subtle, I think.
I wonder if that was, I mean, a one-man show, that's incredible. I assume, you know, he memorized it, but is that what he memorized? Wow. Was it an hour and a half long?
I don't know. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
But,
and I know he's not the only one to do a one-man show, you know, lots of one-man shows, but still, any of those, amazing.
Well, and there's, I sent you we're talking about everything but the books. We're doing the trivia up front, I guess, or the context, and I sent you a link to this, but you know, Dickens would go around doing public readings of his work, very popular, and the audiences loved it because they already felt as if he was connected to them, and so this just did more. And there's an actor named Simon Callow, who has actually done a one-man show of reading a lot of Dickens' works because he loves it, and he wrote a book also, and this is another one I'll have to look up the name of so we can put it in the show notes, but he did a whole book kind of arguing that Dickens was an actor first and a writer second, and that his acting abilities contributed to his writing. And I remember reading one of his daughters did a little biography of her father. And she said when she would go up to the office with him, he'd work for, you know, many hours, and she wasn't allowed to talk to him, but he had a mirror, and he would often act out characters and talk in their voices while he was working on something.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he would go around and do these public performances, and his very final performance, where his health was failing and all this, but the first half was him reading from A Christmas Carol. And I don't know how long it was or how much. And then the second half was, I can't remember what it was, but I was struck by that, you know, you're making your final performance. Hmm. So you're going to pick the books you like best. And this is one of them.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember reading something by John Steinbeck. Excuse me. I remember reading something by John Steinbeck. And he said he liked to read his dialogue out loud as well to make sure that it rang true, right?
Yeah, I think that makes sense because you can see if it sounds awkward.
Right. Yeah, good advice.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'd love to see one of those shows, Simon Callow. Simon Callow as Dickens, reading Dickens?
Or is it Simon Callow just reading Dickens? I think it was him as Dickens reading Dickens.
Cool.
And the book, I think he's read the audiobook for Audible, and he's got this wonderful, rich, deep actor's voice. So it would probably definitely be worth listening to.
Oh, cool.
I haven't just spent a credit on it yet, so now I'm going to go do it right now.
Now, yes.
Yes.
Oh, cool. Well, let's look at some of the book. I don't know that we need to recap any plot. You know, it's just so well known. Nope. But you pointed out something really early that I would love for you to talk about. So just to start off, it says, "Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge. A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner." And you were talking about the weather and this paragraph.
Right. Because it's wintertime. It's right before Christmas in London. Very cold. And so he starts off talking about a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone. So you think about somebody working, and he is a businessman, and that's what's emphasized so much. And it says, "Hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire, secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster." And then it starts switching over and using all kinds of weather language and gradually segues into the weather. Do you mind if I
read? No, please, please.
I don't think it's too long.
No. Nope.
"The cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red, his thin lips blue, and spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. A frosty rime was on his head and on his eyebrows and his wiry chin. He carried his own low temperature always about with him. He iced his office in the dog days and didn't thaw it 1 degree at Christmas. External heat and cold had little influence on Scrooge. No warmth could warm, no wintry weather chill him. No wind that blew was bitterer than he, no falling snow was more intent upon its purpose, no pelting rain less open to entreaty. Foul weather didn't know where to have him. The heaviest rain and snow and hail and sleet could boast of the advantage over him in only one respect. They often came down handsomely, and Scrooge never did."
Hmm.
So it's also funny.
Yeah, absolutely. As always, down. Right?
He's never doing anything handsomely. Yes.
Yeah, I love that. "External heat and cold had little influence on Scrooge. No warmth could warm, nor wintry weather chill him. He was isolated from the world." It's like he was in it, but not participating in it.
Right.
Completely untouched by it, emotionally and physically.
"The weather will change, but Scrooge won't."
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, Marley was dead. He lost his friend.
I don't know if he was a friend.
Yeah, I'm not sure that he was either. I just said that, but you're right. You're right.
They make the point that he did business on the afternoon of his funeral and made a good profit.
His business partner.
Yeah.
but that, you know, he doesn't let it touch him.
Right. But the use of language and the comparisons that he makes, you know just how hard it is to deal with Scrooge. And at the same time, although you're not thinking about it that way, he's also making you feel colder and colder and colder.
Oh, yeah.
You're ready for the cold weather that you're going to encounter in the next scenes.
Right, right. And yeah, it's not far later that the fog came pouring in at every chink and keyhole and was so dense without that although the court was of the narrowest, the houses opposite were mere phantoms. Just awesome. Mm-hmm. I love that. So he's describing the office. And, you know, Scrooge had a very small fire, but the clerk's fire was so very much smaller that it looked like one coal. But he couldn't replenish it.
Yeah.
For Scrooge kept the coal box in his own room. And so surely as the clerk came in with the shovel, the master predicted that it would be necessary for them to part. Get out of here.
Yep.
Read the next sentence.
Wherefore the clerk put on his white comforter and tried to warm himself at the candle, in which effort, not being a man of strong imagination, he failed. yeah, I love that line too. Not being a man of strong imagination, he failed.
Yeah, it's, he is terrible. And, you know, of course, you're shown the series of encounters at the beginning where he is saying the worst things ever. Oh, aren't there any, you know, workhouses? No treadmills? And actually, something I was reading says that part of the way this is written is Dickens' response to the new treadmill law, which had just gone in, and it was supposed to try and help the poor. But of course, as happens with many big government projects, what it was doing was destroying families and people's lives in an effort to help them. And so it's wonderfully told in terms of, you know, he's looking at Bob Cratchit's family later and going, well, can't anyone help him? I think that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. He's,
and his own words keep getting turned around on him. Oh, that was, they
the
should
Union
better
workhouses?
Die and decrease the surplus population.
That's it right there. That's the line right there that's repeated to him by the ghost.
Yeah, but when the treadmills and the workhouses is repeated to him later also.
Yeah, the treadmill and the poor Laura are in full vigor then, said Scrooge. Both very busy, sir. Oh, I was afraid from what you said at first that something had occurred to stop them in their useful course. Yeah, I don't know what the treadmill law was specifically, but something was going on.
I didn't go read about it enough, but I know the workhouses were horrible, horrible places. I just read recently for a book club, Call the Midwife.
Oh, wow. How did you like that?
Yeah, it was really, really good.
Cool.
And there's a TV show, which I haven't seen, you know, that most people know.
I've seen probably 4 or 5 episodes of it, and I loved it.
Okay.
Couldn't tell you why I didn't continue, but it was fantastic.
Know.
Yep.
We tried it and just went, it just didn't hit us right, but somebody had picked this book, and it was really well done because it really told what life was like in the 1950s and I guess early 60s in the dock part of London, and it was brutally poor. But the author is very good and even-handed, so the context of it is never given in terms of what you should think now being applied to those people. She's always very careful to tell you, here's the context of how they were living these ways and their customs and everything. But one of the stories that's told is just heartrending, and it's about somebody who was an old lady in the 1950s. But in her youth, she and her family, her husband had died, and she and her young children had to go to the poorhouse. And the way the poorhouse worked was they split the families up. They took the kids away.
Jeez.
The women went here. The men went there. Yeah.
That's horrible. What are you talking about?
Well, I know. And you're thinking, oh, no. They go to the workhouse, but the family should stay together. But no, they split them up. And so what happens is her children all die.
Oh, my gosh. One by one. Holy smokes.
And she only hears about it through hearsay.
Oh, boy.
You know, so it's a brutal story. But what it did was make me immediately think about Dickens, because he was continually talking about the poorhouses and the workhouses and the treadmill law and all that kind of thing, which had a genesis in a good impulse, but were very poorly implemented, you know, and were ruined people.
Wow.
And when I was reading this, I was thinking about that law and thinking about, you know, if if one of those people's salary had failed from the Cratchit's family, what if those people had to go to the workhouse?
Yeah,
that's why
right.
I don't, it's not this book, I think, or maybe it is, but one of his books, they say, you know, many people would rather die, or maybe that was in this book or a movie.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, then they should die and decrease the surplus population.
Yeah, that's what he says. Yep.
That's why they'd rather die.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I think I would, you know, I'm sure that woman's sorry she just didn't take her kids and starve in a ditch together rather than, you know.
Holy smokes.
Guy like that.
Yeah. Wow.
That's unexected turn. Sorry.
No, it's just, yeah, that just blows me away. You know, it's even worse than I thought, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we live in much better times now, don't we? Problems are not all the way solved, but
right.
It seems like, you know, at least that's not happening.
Right.
But I'm sure we would know some horrific stories that have.
As Jesus said, the poor are always with us. So we're always hopefully trying to find ways to help make their lives better. But
yeah,
looking at this, you just go, wow, so inhumane. And that's one of the reasons that the kids under the robes are, you know, this is ignorance and want.
Mm-hmm.
These are huge problems.
Sure. Yeah, so that's what Scrooge says exactly. If they would rather die, said Scrooge, they had better do it and decrease the surplus population. Besides, excuse me, I don't know that. But you might know it, observed the gentleman. So he's like,
yeah.
No, it's not my business, he says. It's enough for a man to understand his own business and not to interfere with other people's. Good afternoon.
Yeah, mine occupies me constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Which really is a great contrast with when Marley's ghost is talking to him.
Yeah.
He says, you were a good man of business. He's trying to comfort him. He's like, business, mankind was my business. That famous line.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, we're not here to be isolated, as you pointed out.
Yes. Yeah, I love the very soon after that, the caroler at the keyhole.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. The owner of one scant young nose, which is frozen. Hungry and cold as bones are gnawed by dogs. Stooped down at Scrooge's keyhole to regale him with a Christmas carol, but the first sound of God bless you, merry gentlemen, may nothing you dismay. Scrooge seized the ruler with such energy of action that the singer fled in terror, leaving the keyhole to the fog and even more congenial frost. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just love the way he writes.
I know.
So it's good.
Yeah. So expressive.
Yeah.
And because this had to be short, you know, he had to be just to the point. And even then, he still got in great details like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I, you know, and he makes points so well. For instance, after Scrooge has gone to his house and seen the ghostly Marley show up in the knocker, and he still goes inside and he's walking through the house because he's thinking about it, you know, and checking things out because he doesn't want to see that face anymore. But it says, let's see, how dark it is. So he's got no lights in there, and only the lights from the street would come in, if then. And it says, up Scrooge went, not caring a button for that. Darkness is cheap, and Scrooge liked it.
Darkness is cheap.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then here he is. He's got all this money, and he's living in this place that sounds terrible. And what's he going to eat? Some gruel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like porridge kind of stuff.
Right.
Nothing good. He's not even enjoying his own money.
That's for sure. Yeah,
he's
not
saving it.
Yeah, it's just like, what's the point? Yeah, it's become its own point. That's God, right?
Right.
Replacement.
Right.
It's a replacement. It's worship. So, yeah, he's not letting it go. This is mine and no one else's. And I'm going to really hold on to that.
Well, yeah. And it's the kind of thing where you think about somebody getting a lot of money and then you think, oh, well, you expect them to have a nicer car, a bigger house, better food, a cook. Mm. You know, he doesn't have anyone or anything, really.
Yeah.
And money is nothing.
That's
it's
right.
Just a representation of work.
Sure.
Or a value of some sort, you know, but it's a symbol.
Yeah. That's right.
So he's in love with the symbol.
He's in love with the symbol, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that symbol replaces, yeah. That's what, yeah, we talk about the an idol, right? Place no god above God.
Yes.
Right. And for him, he did.
Yeah, and he's pretty, and I think it's kind of funny that he hates Christmas so much. They don't really specify why. He just doesn't like the whole thing. His nephew comes to ask him to a party. He's like, I don't think so. You married somebody who was too poor. So that's money.
Yeah, and he does say, you're not going to pick my pocket every 25th of December. You know, so he does keep, you know, it is consistent with the money thing. Mm-hmm. Where he's like, you know, I hate Christmas because everybody stops working. And he also says,
you're right.
It's not my job to make idle people marry. You know,
yeah.
If they don't want to be working for money, then I'm certainly not going to give them to them.
Yeah, that's so, you're right. It all does go back to money, however obscurely. Because that's when I remembered that the nephew, he's like, oh, you married a poor girl.
And yeah, it's like, there's money there too.
What is that even to do with him? Nothing.
Yeah, nothing. Yeah.
And what difference does it make to him if idle people are married? Nothing. Right. He just doesn't like it.
Right. And then Marley shows up. Mm-hmm. Right? Dragging a chain.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And even then, I kind of have to, I mean, I know this is Dickens being funny, but I kind of love Scrooge's spirit when he's like, you know, well, you might not be real. There's more gravy in the grave about you. Famous line.
Yep, yep.
And, of course, he's soon frightened after that. But
yeah, sure enough.
But I'm like, it doesn't take much for him to feel very sure of himself.
Yeah. The chain's made of cash boxes, keys, padlocks, ledgers, deeds, and heavy purses wrought in steel. His body was transparent, so that Scrooge, observing him and looking through his waistcoat, could see the two buttons on his coat behind.
Oh, right.
Yeah. How cool.
I forgot that.
Yeah, love it. Love it.
And the part from that I didn't remember is when Scrooge, when the apparition, Marley, mm-hmm. goes to the window, and he has him come closer so he can look outside, and he sees all these ghosts and hears all the wailing. Mm-hmm. And he sees all these ghosts, and they're all upset because they can't help anybody. And so he knows one of them, or he knows some of them, and he said he was really familiar with one old ghost in a white waistcoat with a monstrous iron safe attached to its ankle, who cried piteously at being unable to assist a wretched woman with an infant whom it saw below on a doorstep, upon a doorstep.
Wow. Yep.
Yeah. They were all trying to fix things because now they could see clearly, but they couldn't do it.
Mm. For sure, yeah.
But I didn't remember that scene. I mean, I've seen it in the movies, mm-hmm. and I always thought it was added in.
Yeah. There's still room for another film version of this. You know, a super yeah. faithful one with all this stuff in it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, really good special effects. Yoda could mm-hmm. be in it. No. He's not doing anything at the moment. They could hire him.
Yeah.
Let's see. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, at this time of the rolling year, the specter said, I suffer most. Why did I walk through the crowds of fellow beings with my eyes turned down and never raise them to that blessed star which led the wise men to a poor abode? Were there no poor homes to me which its light would have conducted me? Were there no poor homes to which its light would have conducted me? Yeah. Not paying attention, right? Too busy to listen.
Right. And wouldn't listen if somebody did get his attention.
Right.
Yeah. Thought he knew best.
Yeah, and he's telling Scrooge. Scrooge was very dismayed to hear the specter going on. Let's just read the whole thing. And began to quake exceedingly, so now he's scared. Yeah, hear
it's
me.
Like the annotated version.
Yes, my time is nearly gone. That's right. This is going to be about 3.5 hours long. Yeah. Perfect. But you know, I hope we're conveying, you know, what I love so much about it, and you obviously like it a lot too.
Mm-hmm.
There's just it's just full of it's full of wisdom, and when you read it, it's one of those books that you finish and it's worthwhile. It makes you better. It makes you want to be better.
Yes.
So there's just, you know, it's just got all these things, and it's just beautiful. The writing is fantastic. The story is great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I saw someone on Goodreads talking about it. I was just kind of looking over the reviews there, and somebody had said that they had been feeling in a Scrooge-ish sort of mood, but very down about Christmas. This is from a few years ago, but they'd said, you know, their child had turned 14, they had gotten rid of the tree they'd always put up. It was December 29th. They hadn't done anything for Christmas yet in terms of decorating or anything. Mm-hmm. And so they were feeling very glum, and not about that necessarily, just down. And this person sat down and read the book, and you know, you can read it in a really short time. It's right. Not that long.
Yeah, you bet.
In an evening.
An hour and a half, probably, yeah. 2 hours.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I got my copy. This is my excuse to get my copy of the book, in the one I'd been wanting for a while. And so I just sat down to read a paragraph, and I got sucked in. An hour and a half later, there I was, finished. Wow. But they said they got done reading it, and suddenly it was kind of like Scrooge. They saw everything differently, and they gathered up their family and, you know, started getting in the mood.
Oh, that's cool.
So yep. It just changed how they looked at the world.
Mm.
And like you say, it's, you know, God is mentioned in here, of course, a lot, because that's the impetus for everything in here, is that's why mankind is your business. We're here to help each other and to be kind to each other. And Marley was saying, why didn't that star lead me to anybody?
Mm-hmm.
But it also goes to just the human feeling of we're meant to be with other people. And yeah, it's a pain sometimes, and yeah, it doesn't always work out, but that's why we're shown the Cratchits. One of the things I love about this book is that there are so many doubles and reflections of each other, which we already know from Bleak House. Dickens does a lot of that kind of thing anyway. And so, you know, the Cratchits are a direct, both a compliment to, like, the nephew who's having his games and his party, and he's got money, mm-hmm. or more money.
Yeah.
And there's the Cratchits, very poor, but also having fun at their party in their own different way. And then, of course, he's a contrast with Scrooge, who has nothing. And it says, at one point, there was nothing of high mark in this. They're talking about their songs they were doing and their jokes they were telling and everything. It says, they were not a handsome family. They were not well-dressed. Their shoes were far from being waterproof. Their clothes were scanty. And Peter might have known, and very likely did, the inside of a pawnbroker's. But they were happy, grateful, pleased with one another, and contented with the time. And when they faded and looked happier yet in the bright sprinklings of the spirit's torch at parting, Scrooge has had his eye upon them, and especially on Tiny Tim until the last.
Until the last, yep.
Right. And so the whole way through, you know, you're shown... Of course, we're invited to compare and contrast Scrooge's childhood youth from Christmas past. So we see where he got where he is. And then there's Christmas present, where he sees what everybody else is doing and what he's missing and how everybody's thinking of him. He's getting that real view. And then the future, of course, which is a dreadful, dreadful view.
Mm-hmm.
But within this, there are all these characters that contrast and compare with each other to just kind of enrich the story.
Yes. Yeah, I wonder, I mean, is Scrooge as a young boy a double to Tiny Tim?
Oh,
interesting. So you said that, and it just made me think of that. So in the stave before that, we're seeing Scrooge as a young person. And he says, they went, the ghost and Scrooge, across the hall to a door at the back of the house. It opened before them and disclosed a long, bare, melancholy room, made barer still by lines of plain deal forms and desks. At one of these, a lonely boy was reading near a feeble fire, and Scrooge sat down upon a form and wept to see his poor forgotten self as he used to be. So how...
You know, go ahead.
I'm just wondering, how would that be a double for Tiny Tim?
I was wondering, when you were reading that, I was thinking about his sister, Fan.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if she was like Tiny Tim's double.
Oh, maybe.
She's frail. You know, she dies. She gets married and everything, but she dies.
Yeah.
But her coming there, even she's a little child, much younger than Scrooge, makes him happy, changes everything. She's able to talk the father into changing his mind and letting Scrooge come home.
Yeah.
So he had in his own life a Tiny Tim. And I hadn't thought of that until now.
Right, right. Interesting.
Yeah, so maybe he resonates with Tiny Tim even more than we just think from the surface.
Yeah, maybe so. And And yeah, he says, you know, as he sees Tiny Tim, the ghost of, let's see, this is the ghost of future. Where is it? The second.
Oh, that's the past.
No, the one.
Oh, the present.
Yeah. Okay. So he says, so Scrooge says, no, said Scrooge. Oh no, kind spirit, say he will be spared. Right. So he's talking about, I guess I should back up. Spirit, said Scrooge, yeah, with an interest he had never felt before. Tell me if Tiny Tim will live. I see a vacant seat, replied the ghost, in a poor chimney corner and a crutch without an owner, carefully preserved. If these shadows remain unaltered by the future, the child will die. No, said Scrooge. Oh, no, kind spirit, say he will be spared. If these shadows remain unaltered by the future, none other of my race, returned the ghost, will find him here. What then? If he be like to die, he had better do it and decrease the surplus population.
Yeah.
And then Scrooge hung his head to hear his own words quoted by the spirit and was overcome with penitence and grief.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. So now he knows somebody personally, which is why he was separated by the weather. And now the weather's touching him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He feels the cold.
He does. Yeah.
Well, and
the warmth later, right?
Right.
He feels it all. Right. You got to have it all. It's all one big thing.
Yeah, because he feels the warmth, but he feels the cold that will be there if Tiny Tim's gone.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's a good point.
The cold makes him feel the warmth.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about doubles also, and think of Fezziwig, his former employer, and he's seeing how much fun everyone was having. And, of course, right before that, we had seen him very cold-heartedly chastising Bob Cratchit. Don't you be late. I suppose you want the whole day off.
Yeah.
You know. Mm-hmm. And here's this guy shutting the place up and throwing a big party for everyone. Music, food, dancing.
Yeah.
And Scrooge is remembering it. And then he says, of course, he felt the spirits. He's saying it wasn't how much it cost. Says he has the power to render us happy or unhappy, to make our service light or burdensome, a pleasure or a toil. Say that his power lies in words and looks, in things so slight and insignificant that it is impossible to add and count them up. What then? The happiness he gives is quite as great as if it had cost a fortune. He felt the spirit's glance and stopped. What is the matter? Asked the ghost. Nothing in particular, said Scrooge. Something, I think, the ghost insisted. No, said Scrooge, no. I should like to be able to say a word or two to my clerk just now. That's all. And so not only are we shown the doubles, which makes the real contrast, and we're told about it, so we don't have to guess, because, you know, we're not here to take a class.
Yeah.
But we also are shown how gradual his conversion is. It's not he suddenly sees one example and goes, oh my gosh, I was wrong. It's all the little things, the little realizations all adding up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's which makes believable. It makes it believable. Right. I felt that it's difficult to do this believably. Well, we saw it, you know, recently saw Star Wars, you know, so it's on my mind. But, you know, the transition, the opposite direction from little Anakin Skywalker to Darth Vader is unbelievable, in my opinion.
Right.
They did not do it well, you know. And now this is really believable, yet it's hard for an actor to do. You know, when you see an actor do it well, it's great. But it's hard to make that believable. And Dickens just, he does it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that I was complaining a little over having the shortcut. Well, I think I mentioned it, cutting out part of the nephew's party, because you see how involved Scrooge is getting. And he's, of course, later realizing, I would like to go to that party. It would be fun.
It would be fun, right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And fun is okay. It's worth it.
Right. Yeah, fun is okay.
Yeah.
That's for sure. That's for sure. Interesting. So, yeah. So the last ghost that doesn't really speak.
Right.
That was some amazing stuff.
Yeah, in fact, I guess I can think of one time when that ghost really communicates other than just pointing or whatever it does, is that it's like he hears the words in his head or something.
Yeah.
I think it's when it wants him to pull down the covers.
Right.
And he's saying, I don't really want to do that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yep, I'm looking for that too, but...
Yeah, I'm... Oh, here we go. Let's see.
Yes.
Well, I found it, but it says, so there's the bed and it's too dark and it's pointing. And he's like, you know, just touching it with a finger would move the cover and he could see who it was. And he's like, I don't really, I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, let's see, a cold, rigid, dreadful death, set up thine altar here and dress it with such terrors as thou hast at thy command, for this is thy dominion. But of the loved, revered, and honored head thou canst not turn one hair to thy dread purposes or make one feature odious. It is not that the hand is heavy and will fall down when released. It is not that the heart and pulse are still, but that the hand was open, generous, and true, the heart brave, warm, and tender, and the pulse a man's. Strike, shadow, strike, and see his good deeds springing from the wound to sow the world with life immortal. No voice pronounced these words in Scrooge's ears, and yet he heard them when he looked upon the bed.
Yeah. Did Dickens write about ghosts anywhere else? And anything else that you've read in any of the other novels?
Well, I've read them all. And nothing is springing to mind. There may be something. Nothing is. Well, he wrote some other Christmas books, and I think there's a ghost in one of those, but nothing as striking as this. And those Christmas books were not as successful as this, and they weren't as good, I think, you know.
Yeah.
But, I can't think of any.
Okay. I was just curious. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but reading this makes me really want to, you know, start at the beginning. Yeah. If you were to choose a Dickens book other than this one to introduce someone to Dickens, which one would it be?
And you know the interesting thing about Dickens, this is really hard because his books can be so different.
They're different from each other. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, think about Bleak House and think about this. They're both obviously Dickens, but they're both so different. Now, one's real short. But actually, I think I would say either Little Dorrit or A Tale of Two Cities.
Okay.
And I'm sorry I made you read Bleak House when you hadn't read anything.
No, Bleak House was one of those, you know, it was fantastic. Bleak House was amazing. One of the favorite books that I've read in this podcast.
Yeah,
I really loved it.
Well, in fact, I'm halfway through rereading it now.
Oh, are you? Oh, cool.
Yeah, I just had to have some Dickens. I don't know what it is with me.
Sometimes you just gotta have some Dickens, yeah.
Yeah, and so I hadn't read that since we talked about it, and I've read all the other ones now. So.
Is this going to be, did you just go through a year of Dickens?
You kind of have
an author where you kind of hit that author a few times in a year.
I finished up my year of Dickens in that I said I was going to finish reading all the novels of his I hadn't read. And I did that fairly early in the year.
Oh, good.
And I was surprised because even the ones that people don't like or don't even know the names of, like Barnaby Rudge or Martin Chuzzlewit, I may not have loved the entire book. It may have been flawed. But there were still things in each one that I really, really liked and that make me not sorry to think I'll reread them sometime.
Nice. Nice.
You know?
Yeah.
And he'd do things that you don't expect, like Barnaby Rudge. That character is mentally handicapped.
Huh.
Pretty severely.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting choice to name the book after him.
Yeah.
You know, and it's about the riots against Catholics.
Oh.
It went on in London for 3 days. It was kind of like his precursor to A Tale of Two Cities.
Cool.
It's his other historical novel that no one's ever heard of. But yeah, I would say A Tale of Two Cities is amazing, and it's also fairly short.
Okay.
And I love Little Dorrit, although, golly, there's also Great Expectations.
All of them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was really hard to read because the hero, I mean, the main character is really an anti-hero, and he really is. You don't really like him. I didn't. And it wasn't until I discovered that Dickens was really interested in trying to write a book about anti-hero, and I went, well, okay then. Mm. And at the last fourth of the book, I went, oh, I see what you're doing. Okay. Redeemed the book for me. So, that's yeah.
Good. Cool. Well, that's cool. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
So, there's one more I'd like to read. I think we're getting pretty close to finishing this up. But Scrooge says, before I draw nearer to that stone to which you point. So this is the ghost of the future pointing mm-hmm. at a stone. Answer me one question. Are these the shadows of things that will be? Or are they shadows of the things that may be only? Still, the ghost pointed downward to the grave by which it stood. Men's courses will foreshadow certain ends to which, if persevered in, they must lead, said Scrooge. But if the courses be departed from, the ends will change. Say it is thus with what you show me. The spirit was as movable as ever. I like those lines, you know, and I like the resolution of the book because, you know, it does say, you know, we've got free will. This thing is not a programmed thing. We're not programmed people. We have choices and we're responsible for those choices.
Right.
And we should make the best choices we can. Right.
Yeah. It's never too late to turn over a new leaf. Also, no one is beyond hope.
Yep.
You know,
no one is beyond forgiveness. Nobody.
Right. And we all need mercy.
Yeah.
You know, even the people who it's very hard to forgive and to be merciful of can sometimes be us. And we don't know it. We're like Scrooge.
Yep.
We're so blind. Well, and also the whole theme of course, Dickens was always interested in, you know, talking about the poor and how much help they need and, you know, how to be fair to them and everything. But this book, of course, makes the point that should be so obvious to us and is sometimes so easy to forget, which is that physical poverty and riches aren't nearly as important as spiritual poverty and riches.
Yeah. Agreed. Now, you know, and that's you know, the Ebenezer Scrooge we see at the beginning, who's eating gruel by himself. Spending no money, right? He is rich, right? He's rich. Mm-hmm. And then we see the Cratchit family who's having a good time with what they've scrounged up to eat. But they're enjoying each other and happy. And so it's simply saying that there is something about, you know, participating in the community, being part of something. But it's like what you said. You know, we can't isolate ourselves and be happy.
Yeah, and being content with what you've got and using what you have to help other people. And it doesn't have to be, we're not all like Scrooge.
Right.
But think of Tiny Tim when, I guess the father, this is when you see in the future, or no, I guess this is in the present, and he brings him back from Christmas church, and he says he hoped that it was pleasant for people to see that little crippled boy and think of, you know, him who helped heal cripples on this day.
Yeah.
And so that's also the idea that you enrich other people's lives by just being yourself too, you know, as honestly as you can.
Right. Yeah. And I like that, you know, this image of someone who's completely isolated and untouched by anything, needs to be touched by something. Right.
Right.
And he is. And that's one of the images that I just love about the book. You know.
Yeah, and it's like, it's
you got the highs and the lows, right? And sometimes a person would isolate themselves because of fear, and they're, you know, I don't want to be let down, right?
Right.
And therefore, you give up the high, you know, for fear of the down, for fear of the low.
Right. Well, and I was thinking it's also like when you do an examine of yourself and you just, well, I'm everything's going okay. And suddenly something comes to mind. You're like, oh, really? Oh, I did that thing. Or I didn't do that thing. Or, yeah. And it's that's the same conversion and realization that Scrooge has. It's just his is on a bigger level because he's got so much further to go. And that's where I'm so grateful that God is so kind with people who need kindness. You know, in my own instance, I wasn't aware of how I had been treading before I found that truth that is God. Yeah. I met him. And so I look back sometimes and I think, well, I could feel bad about it, but I didn't know any better. You know, there's a reason I was, you know, pinched or unhappy or kind of mean sometimes or whatever it was in the way I was before I found Christ.
Right.
You know, I've said I'm sorry and I just move on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Scrooge. He doesn't go around feeling bad because, oh, I'll look silly to people or anything. He's just like, huzzah!
If only it was like that. You come out of confession or something. Huzzah! I'm totally different now.
Yeah.
I am extra awesome.
Exactly. And I will spread money everywhere.
That's right.
But he also does the follow through.
Yes.
You know, they say for the rest of his life, he didn't do that thing that we all do about something. You make the resolution, but do you keep the resolution? You don't
keep the resolution. Right. Yeah.
And he did it. He had a real conversion of heart.
Yeah.
And that's what Charles Dickens says in his foreword to the book, right? Author's preface to the first Christmas book. I have endeavored in this ghostly little book to raise the ghost of an idea which shall not put my readers out of humor with themselves, with each other, with the season, or me. May it haunt their houses pleasantly and no one wish to lay it. Their faithful friend and servant, Charles Dickens, December
1843. Mm. Yep. Way to go, Chuck.
Yeah. And so much later, it's still giving. I mean, it's
sure is.
Talk about a truth everybody recognizes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's what I love about it. That's what makes it so great. Such a good introduction to Dickens, really.
Amazing. Yeah. So if you haven't read this, give it a try.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And I'm so glad you picked it. You know, you were saying, oh, well, it's so cliched. I'm like, no, it's a classic.
And it is. Yeah, it's cliched, but I continually read it. It's just, every 2-3 years, out it comes and I read it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's good. It's good every single time.
Yeah, it is. There's always something different in it. And even the stuff that you know is wonderfully refreshing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, fantastic. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, that was good story 149. That is the end of, do I put a timestamp on this? Because, you know, remember in the future.
Do it.
2016.
Yeah. Right.
So that's the end of our year. Yeah. It's a good year. We got a lot of good stuff this year.
Yeah.
Really fantastic. Dante.
Oh, my gosh.
Dante was the best achievement. Yeah. The biggest achievement.
That was a big one.
It was, yep.
It's like the year we did The Lord of the Rings, but even more so.
Yes, fantastic.
I think we could go a year without doing a big project.
For sure.
Although I thought of another big project we could do.
Did you really?
Well, it's not a huge project, but you know C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned that in the past.
Yeah, that might be fun.
I would sure enjoy that, yep.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about it. All right.
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you for listening, everybody. And if you're listening to this during the holidays, you know, happy holidays. Merry Christmas.
Yes. Merry Christmas and a happy new year. And may we each honor Christmas in our hearts.
Yes, indeed. Yep. Amen. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.